Behind tab number five, Dr. Overholtz is here to give the presentation. I'll probably need a few moments to set up. Whenever you're ready, Dr. Overholtz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the council for the opportunity to come and present a brief overview of some research today that we've completed over the last few years, focusing on the Gulf of Maine Georges Bank Herring Complex. Would like to take a second to just acknowledge my co-authors, Jason Link and Larry Jacobson, who are instrumental in helping to put this research together. We've been able to publish a couple papers out of this, and they came out in 2007 and 2008. I believe you have those. I'll try to just give you an overview of the results and hopefully save time at the end for a couple of questions. So we're all familiar with the geography of the Gulf of Maine Georges Bank region. And again, today we're going to talk about the Herring Complex that's associated with the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank. We're not going to include the predators and the herring stocks that inhabit the Scotian Shelf. We've made every attempt in this analysis to segregate the results to the Gulf of Maine Georges Bank complex. And everybody realizes, of course, there are lots of predators and lots of herring in these other areas, but they're not included in these results. So it's important to separate all that. And that's what we've attempted to do in this analysis. So the marine mammals that are over here and are important to the herring complex on the table are not the ones over here. And we've disaggregated that seasonally and by using results from a number of sources. So the objective, and also I might add, what we've done here is really taken a first cut or a stab at bringing ecosystem issues into a herring stock assessment framework. We have a variety of data available to do that, and we've used a method and some approaches that we've developed to try to make this process useful and give us some estimates that are hopefully going to guide us in the future. Right now, I think this is a sort of a proof of concept approach, but it certainly could be revised and brought into the stock assessment arena at some point in the future. So what we really wanted to do was estimate total consumption of herring by important predator groups. We wanted to estimate predation mortality on herring, determine the impact of predation on herring recovery and dynamics. So we wanted to look at the history of this and see how predation played out over time. And then finally, we're interested in trying to quantify the effect of predation on long-term yield and biomass. Basically, to really get into the issue of can you have a herring fishery and can you support predators too simultaneously. So there really are some interesting predators of herring in the region, and there are four primary groups: medium demersal fish, marine mammals, large pelagic fish, and seabirds, and as well the fishery, all utilizing this this herring complex. If we focus on medium demersal fishes, what I'm talking about here are species like cod, silver hake, dogfish. And what we've done in this analysis for all four of these groups is gone through as best we can, and I think I might add very carefully, to determine the not only the four important groups, but also the important species within the group that really account for the vast majority of predation on herring. Now, there are a whole set of other predators we didn't include, but based on the thorough analysis we've done, those predators would really have a slight or minor effect and would not result in any changes in the conclusions that you would draw from this work. So for demersal fish, can you go back? Sorry. There were 12 species that really were the important ones. I've mentioned a couple, but they include also white hake, a couple of the skates, goosefish, sea raven, summer flounder, those. And of course, some of these have much more impact than others. One of the things we found in looking at our diet data over time, and we have an extensive set of information we've collected over several decades, is that when herring were not abundant, They were not, of course, showing up in predators. When the herring stock collapsed, predators were still focused on them, but at a much lower level. Back here in the late 70s and early 80s, when the herring stock was at its lowest ebb. When herring start to recover, they became prevalent in the diet, both in the spring and fall, of these demersal fish. At the top, we have dogfish. In the bottom graph, we have silver hake. And you can see that more recently, they comprise a fairly large percentage of the diet. So we have a complete reversal over this time span of herring not being in the diet here and being very important here more recently. We want to capture all these dynamics and then bring them forward in a stock assessment. And that's what I hope to present to you today. For medium demersal fish, we used a method where we estimated consumption based on some fairly simple relationships over a 24-hour period. We have an evacuation rate and then the average stomach content. And then the evacuation rate R is a temperature-dependent process. We developed a seasonal cycle for the region and brought in yearly anomalies to estimate the temperature at any part of this time period or Julian date. We were then able to use this relationship to estimate consumption from our diet data for this whole set of demersal fish. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there really are a whole different set of information available to do this kind of analysis. And so they really beg you the question of putting this whole process into what I would call an uncertainty framework. Why do we need to do that? Because some data is better than others. So we followed an approach that has been done in the past. We used some off-the-shelf software to develop this uncertainty framework. And we used either whatever empirical data we had or literature values for parameters. We used available estimates of variability or reasonable ones varying from 30% to 50%. This is a distributional approach. So we used several kinds of distributions to represent the quality of the data. In the case of uniform distribution, that would be relatively uninformative. So it would be the style of distribution you'd want to use if the data you have is rather poor. On the other hand, you might use a symmetrical distribution if you have a little more confidence in the data, and that's what this PERT distribution is. It's a variation of a beta distribution. This at-risk software allows you to do Monte Carlo simulations. So for each of these annual estimates, we did 5,000 iterations. And then over the entire time series from 1977 to 2002, we did that long series in each year, 5,000 draws. And then finally, we also did sensitivity analysis, and then probably most importantly, we were able to put confidence intervals around our estimates. So we wanted to develop this framework that would include everything, good and poor, et cetera, and allow us to move forward with, I think, a fairly comprehensive analysis on this subject. Now, the uncertain parameters in this analysis are population size of predator, the residence time that the predator overlaps with herring, might be a couple weeks, might be 6 months. The daily ration, or how much food the predator eats in a day, and then the percent of that food in each day that actually is comprised of herring. We actually put distributions around all of these for each of these demersal fish and all the other component species we included in the other three groups. Okay, so here's an example then of, for example, for dogfish, we three input distributions. Up here we have abundance, and I'm sorry I can't read this, but these are the other couple of distributions. This one is the diet composition. So because we had a good set of data for dogfish, we were able to put a symmetrical distribution together to represent the percent of herring in the diet. We developed these for all these important predators. As I mentioned, in each year, then, we were able to summarize the 5,000 draws we had and estimate the consumption in any given year, both the mean and the confidence intervals around that consumption for, in this case, dogfish in 1991. So we had a distribution then of actual consumption of herring. And then we assembled this over time from 77 through 2002, and we were able to have a trajectory or a time series of our estimates of consumption. Looking then at all these demersal fish over this time period and all the results, we see that silver hake and dogfish are the most important predators in that group, followed by cod and goosefish. And then the other set of predators, pollock and some of the others, are less important. In total, they're important because they comprise a fairly large amount of consumption of herring, but individually, they're not as important as these several over here. If you sum then the total consumption of herring by this demersal fish group, by far it's the largest group in the four that I mentioned. This is consumption in kilotons or thousands of tons. So you can see that in the early 90s, this group consumed over 200,000 tons of herring. Early on, again, when herring weren't abundant and available to predators, much less herring was consumed. And then when some of the species in this group, like dogfish, white hake, and cod, were reduced in abundance, their impact on herring was also reduced. And you can see here we have error bars around our estimates. Similarly, for marine mammals, we went forward with an approach that we were using to try to estimate consumption. Again, for marine mammals, we have three groups here, the whales, seals, and then porpoises and dolphins. The species list here of the eight most important are fin whales, humpbacks, minkies, pilots, harbor porpoise, white-sided dolphin, and then the two pinnipeds, harbor seals and gray seals. For marine mammals, we use a little bit different approach to estimate consumption, but fairly similar. Consumption by marine mammals was based on the body mass, and then we used some methods to basically construct a time series. Now, as I mentioned, some of the data for some of these species was very good, and in other cases we had somewhat scant information. For example, for the diet composition of harbor seals, we had both spring and fall information, but only a few snapshots. So what we did was put these uniform distributions together, which spanned a wide range to really capture a full sort of impact of this uninformative variable. And that's how we went forward with the diet composition for most of the marine mammals. Again, we, in any year, estimated consumption by whatever the particular species of interest was, estimated the mean consumption and the confidence intervals around it, and then we were able to construct a time series of consumption by that particular species. And then for marine mammals, we were able to assemble a time series from 77 to 02 in similar fashion to the demersal stocks for all the of the eight species. Now, the reason these all ramp up is because over time, starting in the late 70s, these mammals have been increasing. And we use available stock assessment information to try to estimate these rates. And as mammals have increased, their consumption of herring has also ramped up over time. And if you look at the total consumption by mammals in kilotons, or in other words, thousands of tons, you can see that over time it's reached a level more recently, roughly 150,000 tons. Now, again, I mentioned we had four groups, so we also included seabirds, and there are a number of important seabirds. These are marine birds that spend a large part of their life history right at sea. Those included gannets, three species of shearwaters, gulls, and this would be the list. We also had black-legged kittiwakes, two different gulls, and then northern fulmars. Now, there are a lot of different seabirds that are at sea a long time, but these were the ones that we singled out as being important predators on herring. And if you look at the diet composition of a lot of the other seabirds, they're not very important in terms of their impact on herring. Of course, terns and other nearshore species eat juvenile herring. This analysis did not address the very early life stages of herring. Also, the birds that are inshore, such as terns and a number of others, are really not abundant enough to really have an impact at the level that we're trying to estimate here. So they were not included. They would have a minor impact. And then finally, the fourth group are large pelagic fish, and we included three species there, bluefin tuna, mako sharks, and blue sharks. We developed some methods to estimate the impact of these large pelagic fish on herring. So finally, if you look then at consumption of herring by all four predator groups, you notice that the demersal fish are by far over time the largest or have the largest impact, followed by marine mammals. And then the large pelagic fish, those ramp up a bit here at the end. And the smallest impact is the seabirds. Now, over time, there have been major changes in terms of overall consumption by these four groups. For example, if you look back at 1991, most of the consumption of herring was by demersal fish, about 70% or so. More recently, it's sort of an even mix between demersal fish and marine mammals. And the other two have a minor impact. So if you sum all this up, then total consumption of herring by predators during this period, again, early on the order of 50 kilotons, and then ramping up when herring recovered to over 300 kilotons, dropping a little bit when some of the demersal fish declined, and then more recently with increases in mammals, we're back up to about the 300 kiloton range. So that briefly summarizes our results in terms of getting to the point where we could address this information with a stock assessment model and try to estimate key rates and look at the impacts and then estimate whether it's possible to have both yield from a fishery and then also support predators. So, oops, back. Everybody that took my MREP class will remember that you can decompose total instantaneous mortality into its component parts, those being M1, or residual mortality, residual natural mortality, M2, which is really the quantity we're interested in estimating here, and then fishing mortality. For this particular application, we used the delay difference model. We wanted to assess the impact of predators again, and then we wanted to predict fishery yield from this predator-enhanced or mediated system. So one thing we did was, in order to provide a much longer time series, we developed a relationship between what I would call a predator-prey index in kilotons and consumption for that period 77 to 02. We then use this relationship to hindcast the consumption that occurred during 59 through 76 so that we'd have a longer time series to put into our assessment model. I'm sorry things are so bright up front that we can't see these graphs as well as would be nice, but the red line is consumption and the dotted line is landings. So what we found then over this period, this long period, 59 through 2002, is that total removals during the late 60s and early 70s were very large. So if you add up predation effects and the fishery, it's no wonder the stock collapsed. I mean, we were removing extremely large quantities. At the same time, predator biomasses were relatively high, and they were also removing a large amount of herring. Now, more recently, predators removed about three times what the fishery is currently removing. Fishery has ramped up slightly over time, somewhere over 100 kilotons. But the predators, as I mentioned before, are up over 300 kilotons now. So it's about 3-1. If you look at, again, I didn't mention it, but what we did was include this predation, impact as another fleet in the model. So what we did was disaggregated the results from the model then so that we could estimate the predation mortality rate. It's pretty clear that M2s are time variant. That means they're not constant over time. They range from an average of 0.2 in the beginning of the series to up to 0.7, probably an average of 0.6 during the mid to late 70s, early 80s. You can see up here. They dropped a bit in the early 80s when herring were beginning to recover, probably averaged 0.35, 0.4. And then more recently, in terms of M2, they're relatively low rates, less than 0.2, actually. So the rates are prey, predator, and fishery dependent. That's one of the results we found. If you compare predators and fishery results, in other words, the rates, M2 and F, again, you can see that over time, there were periods when these rates were very high. In fact, during the late 60s, when the ICNF fishery ramped up, fish mortalities reached levels of 1 and higher. And then after herring had declined a bit, the predation mortality, because these predators were still focused on herring and there weren't other fish available, at least yet, there was still a component of herring in the predator diet. We had a period when predation and fishery combined caused stock decline, further stock decline, and then I think also probably caused the slow recovery we saw. It took about a decade and a half to really get a significant recovery. Now, if you compare the natural mortality, the predation mortality rates we estimated, we find that they were actually highest when the herring biomass was lost. And the reason for this was that these predators still had a component of herring in their diet. It was small, but since the herring stock was also small, then this rate was relatively high. Now, one of the things we could now do with this new model that includes predation is re-estimate reference points on this complex. And then we can compare them to the assessment where we didn't include predation. And looking at the significant management parameters, or BRPs, for this stock, without predation, and this is a historic result, we had about 220,000 tons as being the long-term yield, a BMSY of about 900,000, and an FMSY of 0.25. Including this large component of predation actually increased the reference points significantly. But remember now, we've also accounted for predation in this. And that's the purpose of doing this analysis. We now have a reference point for MSY of upwards of 500,000 tons, a higher BMSY, about 1.4 million tons, and a bit higher FMSY. Now, one of the things we wanted to do with this analysis was try to put together some methods to look at the trade-offs between predators and the fishery. So we put together a couple of simple empirical approaches where we pretty much thought about just subtracting predator demand from long-term yield. In this case, this predator allocation approach, we did that and came up with a available yield as of 2002 of about 180,000 tons. Another method we used was an average proportion method where we looked at the average M2 over a period of time, applied that, calculated the predator demand, subtracted that from the long-term yield, and came up with about 165,000 tons. And then finally, we used an analytical method where we utilized the FOX model that we had been using in the initial stock assessment, included a predation term, and over a series of predator biomasses, one could estimate then the surplus production available that ranged from 156,000 tons to upwards of 250,000 tons. So at a BMSY then of our at our reference point BMSY, 1.4 million, one could then look at a table where you'd go through and look at different predator biomasses, look at what the demand by predators would be, and then look at the surplus production that would be available for the fishery. So basically, if predators increase, then less fishery surplus production would be available over a full range that we looked at. And then finally, really this is the trade-off graph. If you compare predator biomass and surplus production from the from this predator-mediated system, one can look at a surplus production line for the predators and then also for the fishery. And I call this a trade-off graph because if you read up the y-axis, it'll give you the available surplus production for the fishery and for predators. For example, in 2007, roughly we thought that the total predator biomass out there would be about 1.2 million tons. If you look at that, then you would be able to pull off the fishery and the predator yields off this kind of graph. Now, if one wanted to look into the future and if the large component of dogfish require, if we get white hake back, if cod recover, if marine mammals continue to increase, perhaps we'll get up to, in 20 years, we would get up to a higher predator biomass. In this case, let's say it's 1.4 million tons. And you can see that here's the trade-off. If the predator biomass increases greatly over time, there would be less fishery surplus production available. But even under that scenario, you can see that there's well over 100 kilotons or 100,000 tons available still for the fishery sometime in the future, assuming all that happens. So I think this was one of the important results of this analysis, that there are trade-offs, but under the current situation, there appears to be a fair amount of fishery yield available that can be taken, in spite of having fairly large predator biomasses out there. So finally, to conclude, I think these are the basic things we found in this study. Predation impacts are often larger than landings. If you get both predators and a very large fishery operating at the same time, there's definitely a risk of major stock decline. Predation mortality should be included in stock assessments of prey fish if we can do it. I think it only adds to our knowledge base, and it also greatly enhances our ability to sort of gauge what the system is doing and how important the prey fish is in that system. Single species assessments, in some cases, I think, could be considered optimistic relative to biological reference points, and it's because of these factors and these issues that I've explained to you today. And then that trade-off graph at the end, if the fishery and the predators utilize the same size spectrum of prey, then there's going to be some trade-offs. So my final slide, and you don't have this one, I apologize, but I wanted to put this in because what I've described to you today are the results of some analyses that we've done on the herring complex. But there's also at the same time been several other things going on. And we've had several postdocs at the center. And this new study has just recently come out. And basically it's a multi-species virtual population analysis. They took a hard look at herring and mackerel, as well as the fish predators that utilize them. Hopefully that'll be accepted by a journal and published. And then secondly, this analysis recently came out too, and it was focused in a similar fashion to what I've just described to you on mackerel. So I think we're moving ahead with quite a number of these kind of analyses. I think we're getting some interesting results, and hopefully we can bring some of these new methods and analyses forward in the stock assessment arena. And I thank you for your attention, and If you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you, Dr. Overholtz. Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for an excellent presentation, Bill. One of the things that sort of stuck out to me when you were listing your demersal predators, which are so important, I'm wondering where the striped bass population fits in with your analysis.
They eat herring, but it's very, very seasonal during a very short time of the year, primarily in the fall when they're passing through the Southwest Channel area and also maybe intercepting herring when they're both heading south. But in terms of the size of the striped bass stock and the amount of time that they overlap with herring, it's relatively short, and the amount of consumption would be relatively small. And they would have a minor impact on this resource and would not change the conclusions that I've showed you today in any way, in my opinion.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Overholtz. I had a couple of real quick questions here. I haven't had a chance. We just got this. I haven't had a chance to read the papers yet. Did you find, or did you consider, or is it important, if M2 goes up and F goes up, is there a change in the growth rate of the herring that has to be taken into account?
Well, if both of those factors went up significantly, we'd probably see herring growth increase a bit. If they're significant as they were back in the ICNAF era, then we probably see a stock decline.
Okay. One other one that doesn't have to do directly with herring, but with the PRIT distribution. And this is just a question from my own information on PRIT. Can that be used with a group of estimates? And I'm thinking now of habitat. This is really not a fair question. I just wanted to get your input on this. If we're trying to model the habitat effects using a matrix, and we're using a large number of expert estimates, would the PRIT analysis be something that we could use to rate the importance of each parameter in our matrix?
Well, I often get unfair questions, but nevertheless, I'll still answer it. The power of using a uncertainty framework like AtRisk, which is a piece of off-the-shelf software, there are a whole variety of distributions available, and you can tailor it to the specific issue of interest. And I would imagine that you could put a distributional analysis and include a habitat variable. Anything you have some estimates of, some data for, it's possible, I think, to construct a distribution. And if you really want to move forward with something even more analytical, you can do a fully Bayesian analysis, too.
Paul Howard.
That's a great presentation, Dr. Hoholtz. Question, we do our herring assessments jointly with the Canadians, the TRAC, and I think in the future, maybe long off, we'll be probably doing mackerel. Before we start talking transboundary, don't we really have to know the boundaries and stock identification boundaries of what is a Georges Bank herring, what is a Gulf of Maine herring, what is a Brown Bank herring? How far along are we in identifying stock boundaries?
Well, I think we're fairly far along in terms of the general picture. But as far as, you know, seasonal mixing and a number of other important issues, those issues that make it hard for us to assess single stocks, and again, that's why we're doing this assessment of the complex that includes Georges Bank and the inshore. In order to make really significant progress there, we're going to need more information. We tried to move forward with some morphometric analyses. Recently, we sponsored a master's student at UMass and got some really nice, interesting initial results. But unfortunately, we couldn't continue through with the payday on that, and that was try to get really good estimates of the seasonal mixing rates. I think we have a little information on that now, but not nearly enough to make it the sort of progress that I was hoping for. There are other analyses we could be doing. There is a lack of funds. There's not much expertise in the region now on morphometrics. We were trying to develop some, but unfortunately that didn't pan out for the long term. So we do need a lot more analyses, and in order to proceed with some of the more detailed stock assessments that we could do, we certainly need some more research in that arena.
Anyone else? Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Bill, for a good presentation. And it appears to me that the entire presentation was based on herring as a predator. And one of the issues that's up as prey, excuse me, as prey. And one of the issues that was raised at the herring committee meeting was what is the effect of a large abundance of herring as the predator? And my concern related to that is mackerel. You know, if in fact we're experiencing, which we certainly are, a decline of what we consider the historical mackerel fishery, for whatever reason, is in fact this high abundance of herring contributing to that. So I think the response we got back from the PDT on that was that they didn't find a way to analyze, well, they weren't sure that it could be analyzed, and they questioned whether they could produce a product out of that. The question I would have to you is, is it possible to look at historical abundances of herring and mackerel at this over the time frame that you have the information and determine whether or not one plays any role in the abundance of the other? And that would also apply to species like, say, dogfish and skates. The concern is, you know, we all know that mackerel eat very small animals, but and heron also. So is the comparison of the diet similar enough that it could be a negative effect from an extremely large biomass? Is there any way to make a determination or any way, if time permitted, that analysis could be done, in your opinion?
Well, there's certainly some things we could do. Of course, Jason Link and Lance Garrison did several interesting papers where they were looking at the impact of herring and mackerel on cod and haddock larvae on Georgia's Bank. And my recollection of those results were that it was very minor. There was one situation, if you had one of the two herring or mackerel overlapping at a certain period of time, they could have some impact. There are some sort of results that suggest that the large biomass of herring and mackerel we have out there now are not feeding back terribly on the system, and that's the zooplankton data we have. It shows that over time, over a long period of time, the zooplankton abundance has been relatively constant, even during the more recent period. So I think because it's a really patchy environment out there, and mackerel and herring have a relatively hard time finding food. In other words, they have to actively search for it. They have to find frontal zones where food's available. And also, they're not always co-occurring or overlapped with prey. And also, because of these different results that I mentioned, my feeling is that we're not going to find much. So I think there are some things we could do, but based on information we have right now, I'm not sure how productive it would be.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just follow up. Well, then, is it possible if we get in negotiations with Canada on this mackerel issue that we suggest that the some analysis be done, a study done of the diet of the mackerel that are now in large numbers off of eastern Newfoundland and even southeast Labrador, and see if that diet composition of those mackerel is something different than what we're seeing with herring? Because they don't have, and from my information, they don't have the overlap of herring and mackerel. So is it, in fact, possible, or, you know, is the diet suggest that the mackerel have not moving back as far south as they did traditionally related to the availability of food? So something like that, maybe consider it when we start talking with the Canadians in the future. Thank you.
Certain things there that we could discuss. Yeah.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gaethel and Dr. Pierce.
I had a couple questions, Bill. On the on page 17, those are the kind of the two graphs that interest me the most. I don't know if you have the same presentation, but it's the ones that show the M2 rate and how it varies over time. So my question, my first question is M1 still constant now?
The M1 we used in the analysis was a very small number, I think 0.05 or something like that. And it really represents whatever residual mortality is left, disease or whatever.
Okay,
and so for herring, for something like herring, it would not be very large. So including or estimating M2 on herring covers the vast majority, I think, of the mortality process.
But to get total mortality, you need M1, M2 plus the F rate, right? Okay. My other question is a little more general. I appreciate what you've done here because I've wanted to dissect M for a long time. I think it's important to figure out whether these rates are constant or variable, and this clearly shows that it's variable for herring. The Research Steering Committee, are going to present information in a report to the council on another paper that was done on the trophic ecology of Atlantic cod. I think Jason Link and Frank Almeida were the writers of that, and they show this pattern of gorge feeding that's necessary on high metabolic species like herring, mackerel, and sand lance in order for cod to basically kind of develop their reproductive cycle. So I was wondering what this means in terms of gorge feeding tends to indicate that the fish have to be kind of schooled up and they have to be easy to get vast numbers of them. And I was on Middle Bank yesterday and you haul up a codfish and, you know, there's a pound of sand eels in a 5-pound fish. It's just, they're just swimming around with their mouths open, apparently. So does something, I mean, is a certain amount of fish have to be there in order for this M2 to proceed as it should?
Well, I mean, having a high biomass certainly makes it easier for predators in terms of their encounter rates when they overlap with their prey. You know, keep in mind it's a pretty diverse system out there, too, and there's a lot of prey choices for something like cod. They eat invertebrates, but there's also a lot of other prey fish, and you mentioned one of them, and there are many others. So I think, you know, predators have choices. The oceanographic conditions dictate where they are, where they overlap with their prey. Sometimes they'll actively search prey out. It's a complex process, but having relatively high biomasses of prey fish out there are going to enhance the system. I mean, I think that kind of answers your question.
Dr. Pearson.
Yeah, again, thanks, Bill, for the good work by you and the co-authors, Jason Link and Company. Just a couple of questions. Would you and your colleagues be in a position to perform similar analyses regarding consumption impacts of marine mammals, fish, seabirds on sand lots? We've already touched on sand lots, and the reason why I focus on it now is that Stellwagen Bank Marine Sanctuary Management Plan is up for public comment, and sand lots, of course, is extremely important in the context of that plan. So has that analysis been done, or could you do it?
We could do something with sand lance, particularly with our demersal fish food habits database. They were definitely an important part of the diet, particularly in the late 70s and 80s when they were abundant and distributed over a wide area. Now they're more locally distributed, so getting the sample size would be more difficult. If our groundfish surveys have sampled in the particular areas of interest, then we would have stomachs. Something could be done. I'm not sure it's as extensive as what I've presented to you today.
Okay, good. Thank you. Now, your reports, your analyses go through 2002. We're in 2008. And relative to spiny dogfish, that is one of the major predators on sea herring in the Gulf of Maine and elsewhere, we're now witnessing, very high abundance of spiny dogfish. extremely high abundance, perhaps similar to the way it was back during some of the peak times before the directed fishery developed on spiny dogfish. And the size composition is such that they are now larger fish and they're fish-eating dogfish as opposed to the smaller dogs that had a different diet. In light of the fact that we now have that dogfish biomass back, I'm assuming from the data in your report that perhaps we now have consumption of sea herring by dogfish up around 200,000 metric tons. Again, I'm just pulling that roughly off a figure that you've got in your document. And then I look at bluefin tuna, and I see also the diet of bluefin tuna being strong with sea herring, and that consumption rate also is going up rather dramatically. My question would be, in light of all of these analytical techniques, the techniques that you and your colleagues have developed and have used, would you be in a position to evaluate the impact of recent high spiny dogfish biomass on herring prey availability for bluefin tuna?
The answer to that last question is probably no. We could look at the data we have on the 6 years since we've done, you know, this analysis for dogfish. I wouldn't conclude much about bluefin tuna from that analysis in terms of current situation, because bluefin tuna abundance is much below what it was then. Again, there's probably a few things we could do, but I'm not sure how much.